second case of the day, the United States v. Rettenberger. Mr. Hirsch.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Mark Hirsch on behalf of the appellant, one of the appellants, Julie Rettenberger. As you know from the briefs, we've argued that there are a number of serious errors that deprive the defendants of a fair trial in this case. And before discussing those specifically, I'd like to take a few moments to place them in context. The central issue in this case was whether or not Randy Rettenberger, aided by his wife Julie, my client, was faking a medical disability. There was a trial, substantial medical evidence, largely from the defense, but also from government witnesses, that Randy Rettenberger had genuine medical problems. As you know, there was a prominent neurologist, a professor from Northwestern University, who treated Randy Rettenberger over a four-year period, who observed him, saw him on at least a dozen occasions, and testified as to the myriad of problems that he had, post-concussion syndrome, and various other problems.
How much did the doctor collect for his treatment of Randy?
I don't know whether that is in evidence. I'm sorry. He was clearly paid for treating Randy over a four-year period. I don't believe there's any evidence.
It'd be a little funny for him to testify, yeah, I treated this fellow for 4 years, and, you know, I collected tens of thousands of dollars in fees, but I thought he was faking all the time.
Well, of course he's not going to testify to that. But he also did testify, and he was specifically asked was that if he determined that he was faking, he would admit it. But I think that the plausibility that is among other pieces of evidence, the argument that the government had, the premise of the government's case, that Randy Rettenberger, who by the government's own admission, the government's own expert, had a subnormal IQ, was managed to successfully fake this disability, not only with respect to Dr. Kelly, but the three other experts who also declared him disabled, is, I think, an implausible way to basis on which to build a case. In addition to that, there was objective medical evidence, which really wasn't in dispute, that Randy Rettenberger had a host of problems. He had a sleep disorder, sleep apnea, he had a bulging disc, he had neuropathy, a nerve disorder, and Dr. Kelly explained how those all fit together and how they aggravated his problem. There were some witnesses, including government witnesses, who did testify that Randy Rettenberger seemed to be slow and tired. And, you know, interestingly, the judge had said...
I must say, I don't see that at all. And one of the things I find very odd is the emphasis you put on these tapes. If I were the prosecutor, I would have put the tapes in evidence for the government.
Well, the prosecutor...
To show that this guy is obviously a faker who, you know, he'll say enough to this mock SS... Social Security investigators, so to try to avoid being caught in an outright lie, but clearly misrepresenting the nature of his work with his wife's development.
Well, I would say if you had been the prosecutor, we wouldn't have this serious error. But the prosecution team made the judgment that this was. That
no, you'd doubtless be complaining that the tape shouldn't have been admitted.
No, I don't think so. I think there would be no basis to complain about that because the tape, as you know from our briefs. The tape was excluded. The exclusion of the tape is.
Thank you.
Well, again, I think that the tape shows. The government argued.
The tape shows a liar.
No, that's I respectfully disagree. Without the tape, here's what the jury knew. Here's what the jury heard. The jury heard substantial evidence of a parade of witnesses talking about how Randy Rettenberger had been involved in the Fawn Valley subdivision. And it also heard, and the government stressed, from opening to closing arguments, that this was never disclosed to the Social Security Administration or the other insurers. The concealment argument that the government had was frankly may have been the basis for the jury's verdict, especially given the conflict in the medical testimony and the weakness in the government's own medical evidence. So the concealment issue is what the government identified in opening statement. The opening statement that the prosecutor stood up and said, there are two pictures of Randy Rettenberger, one picture of what he's doing and one picture of what he's telling the Social Security Administration and the other insurance companies. In closing argument, almost the first words out of the prosecutor's mouth were, there's a key concept here. There's a key issue, and that is, what's he saying, and what's he saying to the insurers and the Social Security Administration, and what's he doing? And so it was clearly a key issue. As the trial played out, the government argued, hey, this was completely concealed. They never told that you could have evidence about the subdivision. The Social Security Administration was never told. This tape, which was erroneously excluded, showed evidence that Randy Rettenberger did disclose that he was involved in the subdivision. Moreover, not only did he say he was disclosing, I understand your point, Judge Posner, which is the government's argument, that he was tend to be minimizing his involvement. That, first of all, obviously is something the jury should have been given an opportunity to consider for itself. But consider, at one point in the tape, he's asked, and this is at our joint appendix at page 69, he's asked by the Social Security agent, since you had this accident, did you do any work that you feel is substantial? That's the question. Did you do any work that you feel is substantial? Answer, there was a subdivision. I talked to various people who worked over there. That question alone goes a long way.
You can't have the tape alone. If it goes in, it goes in. And the government will find all kinds of stuff here.
Again, I think the government is hard-pressed to make that argument, given how hard they fought to keep the tape out of evidence. And again, the tape clearly was not hearsay. It clearly was relevant on the issue of what was sent to the Social Security Administration, which the government identified as a key concept, a key issue in the case. And again, given that it was error to exclude it, I don't think this court has a basis to find that it's harmless, particularly in light of the weakness of the government's medical evidence. As I was saying before, this was a case about whether or not the defendant had faked a medical disability. The government relied heavily on non-medical evidence, on the premise that if Randy Rettenberger was involved in developing the subdivision, if he was taking vacations, that is necessarily inconsistent with a disability. And that premise not only was that very simplistic premise not only was not supported by any government evidence, no government medical evidence, all the medical evidence from Dr. Kelly undercut that government theory. Dr. Kelly clearly testified, and it was unrebutted, that with this sort of neurological disability, with this sort of post concussion syndrome with other complications, patients can their experience can fluctuate dramatically from day to day, from week to week, from hour to hour.
You can imagine what an invitation to fraud that kind of argument is.
Well, I'm not sure I understand the point of the question, if it was a question. I think that...
Well, look, if you just say, oh, yes, you've got this condition, sometimes you're great, and then you do business, make a lot of money. Other times you feel dead, as he said, so you're disabled. You get hundreds of thousands of dollars of disability benefits because you have occasional bad hours.
Well, I don't think first of all, the question is whether he's...
Because the volume of the disability, the amount, of disability insurance that he took out, and then his extraordinary physical activity, the rafting and the motorcycling and so on, it makes the case kind of laughable, really.
Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. The government's arguments with respect to the vacations were, as you put out, what you suggested, that these were active, and they were physically active. There was undisputed medical objective evidence that cannot be faked. that he had physical problems. There's no question about that. He had
physical problems, but we can't all do whitewater rafting or take 8-day motorcycle trips to Mexico.
That but again, there's no medical evidence even common sense evidence that's inconsistent with his diagnosed disability. And again, the government's argument was that, you know, if he supposedly, and they explicitly argued this, if he supposedly got tingling in his arms, he supposedly got weakness in his arms, how can he be doing these various things? Well, again, there's no question he had weakness in his arms. There's no question about that. That's objective medical evidence. There was an MRI. There was diagnosed neuropathy. There was a bulging disc. There's no question he had those physical problems. There's no question he had a serious sleep disorder. And moreover, the vacation evidence really is as much support of the defense as it did the government. I mean, the motorcycle trip that you referred to was supposed to be several weeks. It was 8 days because Randy Rettenberger.
Imagine a person planning a motorcycle trip of several weeks and claims to be disabled and have neuropathy and all this stuff and weakness in his arm.
Well, again, with all due respect, Your Honor.
I don't agree, because I don't see how a person can ride a motorcycle hour after hour with weakness in his arm.
Well, again, he cut the trip short. That's what the evidence shows.
He did for 8 days.
Well,
drive a motorcycle with serious muscle problems for 8 days.
Well, again, there's no question that he had these physical problems.
There are problems and there are problems. But obviously, it seems to me, his physical problems were very slight, or he couldn't engage in these strenuous activities.
But you know, again, I think you have to focus on
so-called mental problems, which are contradicted by his activities with the developer.
Well, again, I respectfully disagree that they're contradicted by the activities with the developer. There's no the evidence on that is over a 3 or 4 year period during when this subdivision is being developed. He was involved in developing. It was across the road from his home. But the government presented no evidence that this was inconsistent with his disability. And as I said, all the medical evidence is that it's not necessarily inconsistent with his disability. And then again, that also suggests the significance of the tape, coming back to the issue of the tape that you raised. Given that the medical evidence was, there was substantial medical evidence presented by the defense, the government stressed the concealment evidence. The government stressed, he's engaged in these activities, it wasn't disclosed. The fact that it's not disclosed is evidence of intent to commit fraud. So again, the key piece of evidence that the defense has to rebut that concealment argument is kept out of evidence, really for completely contrary to the rules of evidence. It's clearly not hearsay, and it was error.
What was it that you proposed to introduce? Just the portion of the tape dealing with the real estate development, or the whole tape?
The whole tape. But
unfortunately, the whole tape has got lots of stuff in it that would have been admitted for the truth. And it may well be that statements about the development were not hearsay, but demonstrating that a statement on the tape is not hearsay won't allow admission of the whole tape.
Well, a couple of responses to that, if I may. First of all, I submit that every word that he utters on that tape is admitted for a non-hearsay purpose. Because
most of the things he uttered aren't relevant if admitted for a non-hearsay purpose.
Well, if the issue is, as framed by the government, what did Randy Rettenberger tell the Social Security Administration? That everything he says on the tape to the Social Security agent is relevant evidence. Some of it may not be very important, may not carry a lot of weight.
Why is it relevant to the fact, the charge in this case?
Because the issue is, because the government argued that he had concealed his activities from the Social Security Administration. They specifically said, and they charged, some of the specific counts are concealment from the Social Security Administration, but also the fraud.
Didn't charge him with concealing most of the stuff that was on that tape. Therefore, I can't see why it was relevant to the charge.
Well, even if it's not relevant, and I agree, some of the times they're discussing things that aren't particularly important. But
exactly.
But
It would be relevant only if admitted for the truth of the matter stated by Randy.
But that's neither here nor there. The central point
here, if you propose to admit the whole tape.
Yeah. There are parts of the tape where Randy is talking about how he's feeling and that sort of thing. They are no more or less hearsay or non-hearsay than the various other government exhibits where Randy's submitting written form where he's asked questions about his physical and mental condition. He submits those and those are admitted. Anything he says to the Social Security Administration about his physical or mental condition is relevant evidence. Moreover, the defense counsel did, once the tape was excluded, defense counsel did offer or did inquire about simply calling the agents and having him testify about the conversation. That was not permitted. So I don't think there's, with all due respect, Judge Easterbrook, I don't think there's an issue here that some of the tape could have been admitted and some of it couldn't. Even if that would have been fine, frankly, if the court had wanted to redact parts of the tape the government said was quote unquote self-serving hearsay, that would have been fine. Our point is that Randy Rettenberger was entitled, and Julie Rettenberger was entitled, to introduce evidence that was not hearsay, that had Randy Rettenberger telling the Social Security Administration that he was involved in the subdivision, particularly where the government argued that was concealed. It's simply extraordinary. It's an egregious error that the government should be permitted to argue that this is a key issue and then have the tape excluded. And then I also address there's a number of errors obviously that are raised in our brief. Another egregious error that we've raised is the exclusion of the part of Dr. Kelly's testimony where he was going to essentially take on head on the government's two expert witnesses. As you know from the brief, the government's expert witnesses were not even neurologists. They were psychologists and psychiatrists who were hired by the insurance companies to conduct a so-called independent examination of Randy Rettenberger. And they relied, not exclusively, but heavily on the results of a test, the MMPI-2 test, which they claimed showed that Randy Rettenberger was malingering. It was a 550-question multiple-choice test. It was incumbent on the defense to address that directly. It's the sort of evidence I submit that has
the test the test that he filled it out, is that in the record?
The test is in the record.
With his answer?
It's attached to Dr. Caldwell's report, which is in the record in the government's joint appendix. I think it's the first.
Now, your fellow Kelly, was he aware that this psychologist were going to testify?
He was aware they had issued reports. I don't know whether
he seen the report?
Yes. I believe he had. And it was obviously the...
So he could have said in his report that one of the things he was going to testify to was the fact that the answers that Rettenberger had given on this MMPI test were consistent with his medical problem, something like that.
I don't know the chronology, but I believe you're right that he could have... His report could have mentioned the other experts' reports. I certainly didn't. I'll acknowledge that. But the point is, and as we've argued in the brief, don't think that's a discovery violation. But even if it is,
why isn't it? I mean, the expert is supposed to, in his report, indicate what his testimony will be. And if he's going to testify about this MMPI, then why doesn't he say so?
Well, actually,
maybe the government would bring in some, would say, well, I guess we'll need to beef up our psychiatric evidence because this neurologist says the MMPI answers were consistent with his head injury.
Well, we don't know what the government would say because there was never any inquiry by the district court into the question of prejudice. That's one of the main problems here. The government never argued that it was surprised by this evidence. The government simply said there's a discovery violation.
What the witness would have said.
Well, we don't know exactly what the witness would have said, but we do know that the witness...
Isn't that a problem?
No, it's not a problem.
No offer of proof?
No, it's not a problem because this court has said...
What the reply brief says is that it's not a problem because we know the witness's bottom line. But that's not what an offer of proof is for. It's to show the reasoning process that leads to the bottom line.
Well, I think the offer, well, I don't think a formal offer of proof is required.
It's explicitly required by the federal rules of evidence.
Well, I believe we've
tried to be clearer.
Well, we cited case law, with all due respect, Judge Easterbrook, we cited case law.
I don't know what all due respect implies. That implies no respect.
No,
that's what that phrase is used for.
It implies that I'm disagreeing with you. This court has said that there need not be an offer of proof if the basis for the expected testimony is otherwise discernible from the record. And that is our position here, that we know Dr. Kelly would have testified that
I would be interested what he would say about this test, because the psychologist is testifying that these answers are so crazy that they're obviously fake. Now Kelly could say, well look, I'm a neurologist and a concussion can cause people to give, you know, these random fake sounding answers, but it doesn't show that they are faking.
Well, again, I'm cutting into my co-counsel's time, but I'll certainly answer your question. Again, I think the point here is this. I think it's a very fair inference from the record that he would have rejected the findings rejected the MMPI-2 and said that's not why, that he did either disregarded it or didn't give it enough weight. We don't know exactly what he said.
We don't even know if he ever looked at it.
No,
neurologists must worry when they're filling out disability forms that their patients are fake. So if he saw this form, he might say, well, you know, maybe this guy did pull the wool over my eyes.
When the government objected, the pending question was, how did you take the opinions of Dr. Morris and Dr. Viner into account in reaching your opinion? That's the pending question. That's the question he never got to answer. Undoubtedly, the jury was at the edge of its seat, leaning forward, listening to that question, because it brought to head the part of this case which is the battle of the experts. In other words, there were the government experts, there were defense experts. The jury is undoubtedly very interested in hearing that answer. Not only is he not allowed to answer, but then the judge, as you know,
he doesn't even know whether he ever saw the test.
Well, I think.
So his answer could have been devastating to you.
Well, I think this court has to draw reasonable inferences, and I think that's an unreasonable inference. I think the reasonable inference, and the reason that defense counsel asked him the question, is he would have been able to explain how he took into account.
This is where Judge Easterbrook's question is really very pointed, because your entire case depends on what Kelly would, how he would have answered the question. We don't know, since we don't know whether he actually looked at that test.
Well, again, I think the point is that the defense should have been permitted to present its evidence. I think there's a fair.
Of course, it was permitted to present it. Was there? Did the district judge obstruct an effort to make an offer of proof?
The district judge. There was no discussion of offer of proof. There was no discussion of prejudice.
There was no blocking you from putting this in the record.
I would suggest, Your Honors, that your point about what Dr. Kelly's testimony being speculative, I think that you also can very easily say that the government's claim of surprise is just as speculative, since it was not made at the time. At the time this issue came up at trial. I may see the rest of my time or the next several minutes to my call.
Thank you, Mr. Hirsch. Mr. Shoemaker?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Robert E. Shoemaker, counsel for Randall Rettenberg. Most of the arguments of counsel for Julie Rettenberg are the same as the arguments of Randall Rettenberg, with two exceptions which are in our brief. Before I address a couple of additional points, I'd like to briefly expound on a couple of answers to the court's questions. Judge Posner asked if the treating physicians were paid for their services. Of course they were. They were treating physicians compared to the expert witnesses paid for by the insurance companies and then later by the government. But also, Mr. Rettenberg's diagnosis was also confirmed by a government doctor, a Social Security Administration doctor, during the Social Security Administration review. Second point I'd like to make is the questions about Mr. Randall's activities. Of course, he attempted to do activities. That's something that was recommended to him by his doctors. That was uncontroverted. But it's also uncontroverted that when he attempted those activities, he had problems. that supported his disability. Third point is that the evidence relied upon the government to prove the disability is largely this MMPI test that in and of itself I think is insufficient to support the finding that the government relied on it for. If the test, the score said it would be unethical or unreliable to rely on it for.
To rely on it for what his personality actually was, there was no indication that it was unethical to rely on it for the proposition that he was faking.
Well, I think the letter said
that was the conclusion of the analyst.
Judge Easterbrook, I think the letter was it'd be unethical or unreliable to rely on the test, period. I think we've also cited case law that suggests that a test like this, which I say is essentially a lie detector test, has never been used to support a criminal conviction.
The MMPI is not a lie detector test.
Well,
it's not its function. That's not the purpose for which it's given. But there are ways of using it to figure out whether people have honestly revealed their responses.
I believe the purpose is to determine psychological disorders, but when it's used to test and conclude that one is malingering, then it is effectively a lie detector test. And I see that my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Shoemaker. Mr. Versman?
May it please the court, counsel, I just want to address some of the points that were raised by counsel for the appellant. Counsel for Julie Rettenberger is correct that one of the very central issues of the case was whether or not Randy Rettenberger was disabled. They did present some medical evidence from this Dr. Kelly who indicated that he thought that Mr. Rettenberger was disabled. But it is important to understand that the jury overwhelmingly rejected that evidence because of the fact that there was a mountain of evidence on the other side showing the physical abilities of Mr. Rettenberger.
How do we know they overwhelmingly? Was it a short deliberation?
That's how I'm drawing that conclusion, Judge Plum.
How short was his deliberation?
The jury went out on Thursday in the afternoon and they came back Friday morning. I had estimated about 5.5 hours. The trial took almost a full 3 weeks. And also I am drawing that conclusion from the fact that there were 44 separate counts. When you take both defendants into account, they were all guilty, not a single not guilty. So the jury heard that evidence from the defense doctor and rejected it. As far as the tapes are concerned, I just want to briefly address that.
Yeah, I'm interested in Judge Posner's question, too. Why weren't you just delighted when these tapes were offered? Because, of course, at that point, any confrontation clause objection has been waived. And it certainly looks like inculpatory evidence. Why doesn't the prosecutor say, thanks so much?
That's an interesting question. And that was a question that was being asked at the U.S. Attorney's Office, too. And you are correct. Both of your honors are correct when you indicate that there are numerous lies that are being offered on that tape. The reason for the prosecutorial decision to not admit the tape was the fact that there was so many statements regarding by Randy Rettenberger about his disability on the tape. A couple of examples. He now snaps at his wife for no reason after the accident. His hands shake so badly that he cannot open a milk jar. While having conversations with people, he loses his train of thought. I won't give you more of that, but I guess our concern was that if we put that tape in, basically what we're doing is we're giving Randy an opportunity to testify without having the opportunity to cross-examine him. You're right. Another
you don't need to cross-examine him. All you need to do is put the tape in evidence.
That is certainly...
He didn't testify?
He did not, Your Honor. Julie testified...
Oh, of course, right, yes. That was that issue about cross-examination.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think on that issue, Judge Reinhardt correctly found that Julie really was the star witness for both Randy and herself. She testified that she saw him fall at McDonald's, slip on the pool of soda, that he was disabled and he couldn't do anything, and she filled out the forms based on what she was seeing. So Julie really was the star witness for both of them.
Did he make a claim against McDonald's?
Yes, he did, Your Honor. He filed a lawsuit. Can't remember the amount alleged, but that was filed shortly after the accident. It was in 1995. I can't remember the month. So we made a decision not to seek to admit the tapes. But Your Honors are correct when you focus in on the fact that these tapes are just absolutely riddled with hearsay statements about all of his disabilities. Therefore, they're not admissible. They make this claim now that they are were being admitted for the purpose of showing that these disclosures were made. And I would submit that when you review the tape in its entirety and the transcript is attached to our appendix, that's simply not the case. What he's doing is saying, I attempted to go out and do something on Swan Valley, but I wasn't able to do it because I was aggravating the help because of my personality changes and I had to quit. And I tried to do some bobcatting, but I almost flipped it over on myself, and now I don't think I should be able to do it. So really what he's doing is, and this is one of our concerns, is that he's putting a spin on some of the things that were observed, you know, him out of the site, putting his spin on it and explaining that he really couldn't do those things properly. As far as whether or not this was a question for the jury, I would submit that if the question of admissibility is not a question for the jury. If something's hearsay, it's inadmissible, and therefore Judge Reinhart correctly kept it out. And as far as the statements on the forms that the government being admitted about his condition coming in, obviously we admitted those as admissions by a party opponent. That's why those come in, and you don't have that same consideration when a party is offering their own out-of-court statements.
Is the main evidence against Julie that Ms. Berthman, that she is the one who was the filled out the form, the multiple forms?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that.
How is filling out forms if he's disabled? If that's the strongest evidence, let's just assume we had somebody who was disabled. Let's get away from this case and ask his spouse or a significant other to fill out the forms. How does that become evidence? And you say it's the most significant evidence that they were co-conspirator in a scheme to defraud.
It becomes evidence when that person fills out the forms and attempts to get the disability benefits, knowing full well that that person is not disabled. If I could give you an example, Judge Flom, there was a form submitted to the Social Security Administration on September 25th of 1997, signed by Julie Rettenberg. And she says that she does that based on her honest observations of Randy Rettenberg. And she says on that form, on September 25th, 1997, Randy Rettenberger has stopped or lessened all activities due to inability to cope. Well, she knows full well when that form is submitted that just, I think it was less than 2 weeks before that, is when Randy got back from his 18-day whitewater rafting trip down the Colorado River in the Grand Canyon. So the fact that she is submitting these forms, knowing full well that he hasn't stopped or lessened all of his activities, and that he doesn't have mental problems that are prohibiting him from doing significant work-related activities, that's what the fraud is on Julie's part.
She submits that after he's been examined by doctors, though, right? Some doctors that have concluded he is disabled.
Yes, Your Honor, that is true. However, I would ask the court to consider the fact that she is fully participating in the submissions that are being made to these doctors. I'll give you an example. In January of 1997, that's when Dr. Hoffman, who was hired by the Social Security Administration, first saw them. Well, Julie goes with Randy Rettenberger to this meeting. And basically, what Dr. Hoffman testified to is Randy was so out of it, he couldn't answer any of my questions. He couldn't tell me about his history. He couldn't remember where he went to grade school. So I had to get all of my history information from Julie. And And Julie was actually the one who said, in response to Dr. Hoffman's question about what do you do in a typical day, Julie is actually the one that said that he is, sits there all day and watches TV and smokes cigarettes. So she was participating in this deception on the doctors, is what I'm saying.
Was the motorcycle trip or the whitewater rafting trip, were those mentioned to any of the doctors? I mean, you know, like to Kelly?
I do not recall them, there being evidence that they were mentioned at the time that they occurred. Now, I do recall Dr. Kelly saying that, well, yeah, I've taken that into account, but, you know, I told people to try to engage in these type of activities and to try to do recreational activities. So, and that's not going to change my opinion simply because he tried to do some of these activities.
But
he did say that.
I see.
I'd like to respond to another point that Mr. Hirsch made about Randy's physical problems. Yes, Randy did have some physical problems. There was no dispute about this. He did have this polyneuropathy. And we never disputed that. We never said that he didn't have any sort of physical problems. What we said was these physical problems weren't to the extent that they were causing him to stop or lessen all of his activities, like he's telling the Social Security Administration, or that he was unable to concentrate or think to be able to work on his project. And obviously, the fact that somebody is able to ride a motorcycle for 8 days, I calculated about 600 miles across.
I assume he got off occasionally.
I assume he got off occasionally. That's correct, John. But he did go. If you look from where he started to where he ended up, I think it's about 600 miles. As far as the MMPI being insufficient, I would just like to stress that I think Judge Easterbrook has stated the government's position with regard to what that Caldwell letter and report showed. And that was explained through the testimony of Dr. Viner, I believe, which is that although the MMPI is designed to diagnose psychiatric illness, such as paranoia or schizophrenia. And basically what happened here is Randy, his answers went off the charts for schizophrenia. They went off the charts for paranoia. And, you know, the doctors are saying that can't be right. He'd have to be in a rubber room if those answers are true. Then they looked at the fact...
What would be an example? Because I haven't looked at the... Do you remember any of his answers?
Specifically, no, Your Honor, but it would be like hearing voices and things of that nature. And there was something in this test called a variable response index, and as I understand it from what the doctors testified to, that's something where the test asks the same questions over and over in different forms. And the reason they do that is to look for randomness. Is this guy just going down and filling this out randomly? Right. And when they looked at the variable response index, it showed consistency. So the doctors are concluding is that this is a consistent effort to exaggerate. So Judge Easterbrook is exactly right that although it may be unethical, according to Dr. Caldwell's letter, to use this report for purposes of diagnosing paranoia or schizophrenia, it is the pattern of malingering because it is a intentional exaggeration. And that's what the doctor
said.
Why is
it unethical to use it to diagnose schizophrenia if that's the purpose of the test?
Well, I think it's because, as Dr. Morris explained it, the test was baselined by having people with paranoia and schizophrenia answer questions. So they already knew that these people had...
Once you conclude that a person is not giving honest answers, you can't use the test to determine what his actual psychological state is.
Well, that's correct. That's correct. And I would add that Dr. Morris said that he scored way higher for schizophrenia than people that we know have schizophrenia. So, and then finally,
let me turn to the proposed testimony of Kelly. Why shouldn't Kelly have been allowed to state why he didn't think that Randy was malingering.
He was, Judge Easterbrook, he was allowed to state that he felt that Randy was not malingering. And he was allowed to state that based on his own testing that he did, his own examination, that he was not malingering.
Yes, but he wasn't allowed to state why he disagreed with other people who reached other conclusions. And that's my puzzle. And that experts are supposed to disclose in these reports the general nature of their testimony. But it does seem that the statement, I concluded he was not malingering because X, you know he's going to state that, implies that he's going to state, and here's why I disagree with other people who disagree with me. It's just the contrapositive of what he's already stated. And how do you come up with some, what sense does it make to have a world in which he can state the proposition one way, but he can't state it the other way?
He was not allowed to state his disagreement with the government's doctors because that was not provided in the notice.
But I don't understand why one should not read a notice or report of this kind as implying disagreement with people who disagree with me.
I think you can, Judge Easterbrook. I think
It sounds like the district judge required, and you're standing behind, kind of mindless formalities. You have to put in the report, essentially, every question you think the lawyer might ask, each way of getting at an issue, even though it's perfectly plain that the expert is going to testify about this general subject matter.
I am not advocating that length, Your Honor, nor do I think the district court was. Yes, it was something to be expected Dr. Kelly was going to disagree with the government's conclusions, government experts' conclusions on malingering. However, what we did not get notice of is why. And to this day, and this is why the plain error standard.
I thought actually you were going to make a different point. I mean, suppose that your experts had been nuclear physicists who had sent quarks into Rettenberger's brain and believed as a result of this was clear that he was malingering, then it would be perfectly consistent for Dr. Kelly to say, well, my belief, based on what I did, is that he was telling the truth. I don't know anything about this use of quarks to diagnose, so if those people disagree, I really have no basis for commenting on their view. Wouldn't that be a perfectly consistent answer for him? Maybe he's never seen an MMPI. He's not a psychiatrist, right? He's a neurologist.
He's a neurologist primarily. He has a background in psychiatry, but he is not a psychologist. And as I understand it, the MMPI is normally reviewed by neuropsychologists, which Dr. Morris was. The problem that you have with Dr. Kelly's attack on the government experts is we don't know what that was going to be. I don't know if it was going to be on the basis of backgrounds, whether or not he's going to say that a psychiatrist is not qualified to make this sort of diagnosis. I don't know if it was going to be based upon this Caldwell report about this unethical use of the MMPI. Or it could have been that he was going to attack the government experts based on the fact that he believes the MMPI is an insufficient mm-hmm. test altogether.
All right. So this really comes back to the offer of proof question, doesn't it? If they made an offer of proof which showed that there was no possibility that the prosecution would be surprised, then his testimony probably should have been admitted. If they make an offer of proof showing that there was some real potential need to get other evidence, and so on.
Yes.
And we don't know because they didn't make an offer of proof.
I'd like to respond to that by saying it's possible. Again, we don't know because we don't know what that offer would have been. Was it going to be something that I had already prepared for, that I had discussed with Dr. Kelly and Dr. Morris, and therefore I was in a position to cross-examine? This is a respected neuropsychologist, a neuro neurologist who, you know, is working for the Chicago Bears. He's a prestigious individual. I need to have an opportunity to prepare for cross-examining his opinions and the basis for his opinions. If it's something that I had already prepared for, and that's possible, I would have learned that from an offer of proof. However, it's also possible that he has some other attack that he's going to launch that I had never even thought of before. And by myself, with no medical background, with no access to my doctors who are treating doctors and are in Chicago, I'm out in Rockford, I don't know if I'm going to have access to them or when. It was simply unfair to allow this undisclosed opinion to go forward. And therefore, the judge did not commit plain error when he excluded Dr. Kelly's opinion on this topic. Your Honors, if you have no further questions, I believe that concludes my presentation. I would simply ask the court to affirm the convictions and sentences of the defendants in this case.
Do you have any rebuttal time? You may have 2 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Hirsch.
If I may, I'd like to address the issue you were just discussing. I understand that this court could write an opinion that says there was no offer of proof made with respect to what Dr. Kelly's testimony would have been, and that's the end of it. But the court could just as easily write an opinion that says the government made no claim of surprise, and therefore the court erred.
Well, Mr. Forsman explained that. Mr. Forsman explained that. He didn't know whether he was going to be surprised because he didn't know what the basis of Kelly's criticism of his witnesses was going to be.
My point, Your Honor, is that he didn't tell the district court judge that we're surprised by this, there's prejudice here. The point really is the district court judge acted precipitously, hastily. Simply, there was a short sidebar on a critical issue in this battle of experts, critical evidence to the defense. And the court made, and this court has been clear that there has to be a showing of prejudice in order for testimony to be excluded as a remedy for a discovery violation. There was not even any inquiry into the question of prejudice. And Mr. Bergman's able to talk to you about the government's expert's interpretation of the MMPI. I can't do that because that testimony was never permitted. I can't tell you what Dr. Kelly's answer would have been because that evidence was not permitted.
That's the whole point of an offer of proof, so that we will know what the testimony would have been.
No, I understand, and my point is that the remedy for all this is this case ought to be retried.
But you dropped the ball twice. One was not including any of this material in your report, expert's report, and then not trying to show the judge what Kelly could do and that it wouldn't surprise the government. So why should it be a retrial, especially since the evidence is so strong?
Well, I, again, obviously disagree that the evidence is so strong. This is the case.
Was Mr. Verzman correct that in this MMPI test, Redenberger said he hears voices?
I'm sorry, Ron, I don't know. I don't recall that. I don't know. He may be correct. I don't dispute it.
Mr. Hirsch, did Dr. Heilbronner testify?
Dr. Heilbronner did not testify.
Did Dr. Kelly, when he testified, reference Dr. Heilbronner confirming his assessment?
I see my time is up. I want to answer. Well, that's another issue we've raised in our brief, which is that Dr. Kelly did say in his report that one of the things that he had relied on in reaching his opinion was the opinion in the report of Dr. Heilbronner. Shortly after this incident with respect to the MMPI or the testimony of the government experts, Dr. Kelly was asked a question relating to how he relied on the testimony of Dr. Heilbronner, and the district court judge excluded that, wouldn't permit him to answer, based on, again, what we claim is a misunderstanding or misreading of the federal rule.
And Dr. Heilbronner, as I understand, was a neuropsychologist.
That's correct. And that update relates to this issue as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shoemaker, Mr. Bergman. Thank you. Case is taken under advisement.